Welcome to a sold-out Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom. And what a pairing of two pieces of the ripest late romanticism we've got in store for you this evening. Richard Strauss's Burlesque for solo piano and orchestra, and then the gigantic tragedy of Mahler's Sixth Symphony, all in the company of the BBC Symphony Orchestra and conductor Semyon Bishkov. We start with the Strauss, and a delightful, horrifying piece it is too, this Burlesque. Not my adjectives, actually, but those of the great pianist, composer, conductor Hans von Bülow, for whom the 21-year-old Strauss composed the Burlesque in 1885. But on receipt of the score, von Bülow declared it unplayable and complicated nonsense. Strauss himself tried to take over the first performance of the work's fiendish piano writing in Meiningen, but declared it himself unalloyed nonsense after a run-through. In fact, it wasn't until another 19th century virtuoso, Eugen Dalber, heard about the Burlesque that the piece was first performed, with von Bülow conducting in 1890. And the work was revealed to be anything but nonsensical, but rather one of the most immediate and likeable works of Strauss's early career. You know, it's a funny thing, early Strauss. This is music that's in between all of the major influences of the late 19th century. There's the ghost of Brahms, well, the presence really, since Brahms was only 50 when Strauss wrote the Burlesque, in the terseness of the opening tune that you'll hear the piano play, the spectre of Chopin in the way the second theme sounds, and the shadow of Liszt in the sprawling single movement form. But this isn't program music, though, in the way that Strauss would soon redefine the genre in works like Don Juan and Till Eulenspiegel. But it is a piece full of character, as well as virtuosity, a mix that makes the Burlesque irresistible. Well, I think so anyway. Strauss himself eventually came to love this folly of his youth as much as any other of his works. In fact, it was on the programme in the last concert he ever conducted, a concert with the Philharmonia Orchestra, right here at the Royal Albert Hall in 1947. Strauss, though, did have a vexed relationship with this work. He was offered a load of cash to publish it by a company in the 1890s, but he still wasn't convinced of its merits, so he declined. Applause there for the BBC Symphony Orchestra's leader, Andrew Havram. Von Bülow was a man who didn't mince his words, but a quarter of a century later, Strauss wrote about von Bülow for anyone who ever heard him play Beethoven or conduct Wagner, who attended one of his piano lessons or observed him in orchestra rehearsal. He was one of the decisive factors in my career, the shining virtues of a performing artist. So here comes pianist Kirill Gerstein and conductor Semyon Bishkov for this performance of Strauss's Burlesque with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Thank you. Given an outstanding pianist and a first-rate conductor, perhaps the whole thing will not turn out to be the unalloyed nonsense I took it for after the first rehearsal. After the first run-through, I was totally discouraged. Richard Strauss's own words about the burlesque we just heard played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Semyon Vyshkov, and the soloist, that virtuosic part, Kirill Gerstein. I wonder what Strauss would have thought after that performance. Certainly had this sold-out Royal Albert Hall in the palm of its hand. And something at the end of that music called a burlesque, suggesting the comedy and lightness of some of that amazing filigree sort of virtuosity that Strauss writes, especially for the pianos, but also for the woodwind instruments. But the way the timpani comes back at the end, something darker, as if after all that sound and fury, maybe there's something of death involved here too, the other side of comedy. Timpani, who introduced and closed the work, was played by John Chimes, who's now clapping, the first to clap, actually, as Kirill Gerstein comes back on for a solo bow, the orchestra enthusiastically welcoming John Chimes. Is that the greatest name for a timpanist in the world? I think so. If you want to agree or disagree with Strauss's assessment of burlesque, go to bbc.co.uk/proms and send us your reviews of the piece and that performance. You'll also find at bbc.co.uk/proms tonight's programme, and of course links to all of the other proms that you can hear over the last week. Kirill Gerstein, one of the most adventurous of today's soloists, a repertoire that ranges from contemporary music right to the heart of the romantics like Rachmaninoff and of course the Strauss we've just been hearing. Well, that's interval time here at tonight's prom, and it's time now to join Matthew Sweet for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello, and welcome to this latest Proms Plus literary event, which comes to you from the Royal College of Music, the heart of the Albertopolis, that red brick Victorian cultural quarter that the Proms calls home. Tonight, we're going to conjure up the man whose enthusiasm and whose death shaped the nature of this patch of West London. That's Prince Albert, of course, who embodies the 19th century thirst for knowledge and for art, and who coughed his last 150 years ago this coming Christmas. And to do that, we've recruited two historians who know him and all his works. Dan Cruikshank, who's been championing Victorian architecture since the time when most people thought it was good for nothing but bulldozing, and Kate Williams, biographer of the Queen to whom Albert was Prince Consort. Will you welcome them both? Okay, well, let's start by trying to find the man in the buildings and the institutions that are clustered round us here. Dan, how do they reflect Albert's interests and personality?
Amazingly directly, of course. One takes South Kensington, it was named christened at the time of the creation of Albertopolis in the 1850s. For granted, but of course it's in a wonderful and strange creation. At the time, of course, you know, after the Great Exhibition of 1851, of which it is, of course, a child, it was regarded as often slightly strange and un-English, rather Germanic in its attempt to, in a very methodical way, create this culture centre in London. And it was Albert's, not entirely his idea, but he was a driving force behind it, the idea that England was lagging behind, Britain was lagging behind in the world of commerce and manufacturing, and that it needed an influx of the arts and the science combined to create a better, more profitable world. It wasn't just, of course, just Britain. He wanted to all the nations to benefit. And of course, after the Great Exhibition, when it closes in late 1851, already Albert's onto the creation of this perpetual memorial and continuation of that project, the museum quarter, learned institutions. And it is an astonishing creation, culturally and architecturally.
So, Kate, we've got the V&A Museum, we've got the Albert Hall over the road, the Science Museum, the Natural History Museum. Is this, in effect, we walk around here, is it like taking a tour of Albert's interest, Albert's sensibility?
Yes, completely. I mean, so much of this was built with a great profits from the Great Exhibition. I mean, 190,000 at the time, which is, equivalent to about so, you know, 16 million today, all these profits set up to build these great museums. And really, Albert saw himself as he was a great collector. He loved to collect specimens of things, which Victoria found a bit of a turn-off initially, but she grew to like. And so this was a great big specimen collection of natural history and minerals and art, and he really wanted to put his mark on British culture.
And all of these things would have been found in the Great Exhibition of 1851, wouldn't they, Dan? Amazing machinery, international art. Ooh. Weird things like the Battle of Trafalgar carved in butter, stuffed ferrets yes. arranged in amusing scenes.
Indeed, the inspiration's there. And, of course, some of those things literally end up in the Victoria and Albert Museum as it becomes known later on, South Kensington Museum initially. That's, of course, is the great continuation. But also, fascinatingly, is the architecture, the expression, the physical expression of this great memorial. I mean, overridingly, of course, it's classical architecture. And given the period, you know, the 1850s, he dies, of course, 61, but during the 1850s, it's not the architecture of taste or of choice at that moment. The Gothic is becoming dominant. So, again, it's fascinating. Albert's behind that, too, trying to find a middle road between the great battle between the classicists and the Goths in the mid-19th century. He goes the middle path, which is sort of, again, rather Germanic, sort of a round arch Romanesque style, which is meant to be the best of both worlds, which you can still experience in the courtyard of the V&A.
OK, well, let's try and get some sense of how this man came to occupy this prominent position in British culture and society. Kate, how did Albert meet Victoria?
Well, Albert was Victoria's cousin, and there were Victorians often did marry their cousins, but Albert's family were terribly ambitious. It was his mother, Victoria's mother's family, and they were terribly ambitious. They were from a very poor, this Saxe-Coburg, very poor German family, and his uncle, Uncle Leopold, who was King of the Belgians, was determined that Albert would marry Victoria and was always trying to persuade her to marry him. He wanted to be the power behind the throne through Albert. So they were thrust together to celebrate her 17th birthday, but it didn't go very well. She thought he was rather dull and fond of his specimens, and he thought she was a bit silly and too fond of dancing, and disastrously, he liked an early night, which she did not, and he fell asleep in his plate at her ball. So that was a bit of a disaster.
And what did she write about him? Privately.
Well, she wrote about him to her uncle. She was always very measured about him, but she was very, very keen to be a good niece to her uncle. So she wrote about him, she said to her uncle, "Albert is extremely handsome. His hair is about the same colour as mine. His eyes are large and blue, and he has a beautiful nose and a very sweet mouth with fine teeth. But the charm of his expression is his countenance, which is most delightful." But that wasn't taking her as far as agreeing to marry him, and so Uncle Leopold had a bit more work to do.
So, Dan, there was an attraction there between these two, more or less from the beginning. How did the British public feel about Albert? Did they take
him? Remember how Britain perceived Germany at the time, a rather picturesque country, lots of little towns, and deeply provincial, and Albert strode in, trying to, I suppose, eventually impose a Germanic approach to, you know, organisation, to research. I think he was quite suspicious of what he regarded as a sort of aristocratic amateurism that characterised so many British efforts, certainly in the arts and so on. And I think the swells, the aristocracy here was slightly suspicious of Albert in return. But I think the people generally, certainly after the death, were mortified by his loss and supported the Queen in her great mourning.
He more or less had to create a role for himself,
yes,
though, didn't he? Because
absolutely.
There was no slot for him to fit into.
And he didn't get the title of Prince Consort until, you know, 17 years after they'd been married, because they were very distrustful of him. They felt he was too young, he was from this impoverished country, he was pretty pointless, he didn't bring power or knowledge or money to the British throne. And a rhyme about their wedding was, "Here comes Albert for better or worse, for England's fat queen and even fatter purse." They thought he was rather mercenary. And even Florence Nightingale, when she saw him driving to the wedding, thought that he was wearing clothes borrowed to get married and couldn't even afford his own wedding outfit. And so he really had to carve out his own role. Victoria said, "You can't have Germans around you in the court." And it was a real struggle for him. He said, "You know, I'm the husband, not the master in the house." Even though Victoria said she'd obey him in the wedding ceremony, he felt he was under her thumb. And he tried to do so by, as Dan was saying, systematising Buckingham Palace, which was a disaster of disorganisation, trying to patronise the arts and the great exhibition. So he had a hard job to carve out his own role, and he guilt-tripped Victoria a lot, although who else he could have married, who could have been better, I don't know.
Was he leading popular taste? Dan, or was he trying to take advantage of something that was in the cultural atmosphere already?
Well, he became a figurehead, but more than that. I mean, the people, Henry Cole, of course, is a great character.
Who's the director of the museum of the
V&A, and of course a major force in really the Great Exhibition was essentially his idea, really. He'd been promoting the marriage of art and science and manufacture before that in the 1840s. He got the Victoria to support it. She put Albert in charge, and then it all took off. Albert really put his weight behind it. So in a sense, he was reflecting notions already around, but he did become this tremendous driving force and fantastically enthusiastic.
And how did he shape public perception of the royal family?
Well, this to me is Albert's very important legacy. He and Victoria, they'd seen the kings before them, George IV, William IV, pompous, excessive, all this ermine. The iconography was of the great king covered in gold, which contrasted with the cartoons of them in which they were just jokes, the Prince of Wales, big old fat mammal swimming around in the sea. So the absolute contrast was Victoria promoting herself and Albert as this very middle class, very bourgeois kind of family, very ordinary, no crowns, plain outfits. And often in portraits, he is sitting while she is standing, which is a complete reversal of the expectation of she is the queen. She is serving him as a wife would. So the notion that we like our kings and queens and royal family to look like a ideal bourgeois family is completely what Elizabeth II has used so successfully in her iconography nowadays.
This was a relatively short marriage, though, wasn't it, Dan? Indeed. The hand of death intervened pretty quickly.
Well, that was a shocking thing. He died in his early 40s, very unexpectedly. Of course, Victoria, as we now know, she never recovered. It'd be perpetual mourning, almost, certainly for 30 years, really.
How did he die, Kate?
Well, he died, and Victoria blamed her son, the future Edward VII, for it. He died after going to chastise the future Edward VII for consorting with actresses and having them in his tent. So he, particularly glamorous actress, Nelly Clifton, was in his tent, and he went to Cambridge to chastise him, exhausted, came back, caught a chill, and died very swiftly afterwards. It's thought it was probably typhus that killed him, but it was so swift, no one could believe it. No one even knew he was dead. He was ill. So it was a complete shock, and particularly to Victoria, and she felt incredibly guilty, I think, for overworking him, because the level of support she required was very high.
Well, let's visit that moment now. Kate, you're going to read from Victoria's account of Albert's death, and then Dan is going to tell us how the Times newspaper reported it the next day.
Well, Matthew, this is terribly dramatic. I mean, the Victorians loved to lavish in mourning. There was no, moving on wasn't really their forte, and certainly Victoria is absolutely... She's devastated here. She wrote in her journal, "Never can I forget how beautiful my darling looked lying there with his face lit up by the rising sun, his eyes unusually bright, gazing as it were on an unseen object and not taking notice of me. I stood up, kissed his dear heavenly forehead and called out in a bitter, agonizing cry, 'Oh, my dear darling,' and then dropped on my knee in mute, distracted despair, unable to utter a word or shed a tear."
It's very moving.
It is. I mean, indeed, the Times is moving too. Little snapshot of the popular world as represented by the Times at the moment of Albert's death. It says here, "Quietly and without suffering, he continued slowly to sink, so slowly that the wrists were pulseless long before the last moment had arrived, when, at a few minutes before 11, he ceased to breathe. All was over. An hour after, the solemn tones of the great bell of St. Paul's, a bell of evil omen, told all citizens how irreparable had been the loss of their beloved queen, how great the loss to the country."
So how did the public respond to his death? Is the Times leader here reflecting what people really thought, their real attitude to him?
Yes, Matthew, the Times is absolutely reflecting the real attitude. He hadn't been popular throughout his early life. As soon as he died, it was a complete change in public opinion. They became devoted to him. They saw him as being taken from the Queen, and they were very sympathetic to the Queen, widowed at 42. And the principle is that if you truly Christian, as Victoria was, you can't marry again because you'll meet your spouse in heaven and you don't want two spouses hanging around in heaven, so you're done for, that's it. And so they could see her consigned to a life of widowhood, so they were so sympathetic. And even though he decreed that he didn't want any edifices to him, absolutely edifices mushroomed across Britain, particularly at Victoria's behest.
So, Dan, how quickly did these legacy projects of the Great Exhibition that were seeded all around this area become a kind of mausoleum?
Interestingly, I mean, the Albert Hall, of course, is a memorial to him, started in 67, so pretty soon after the death. And then the Albert Memorial a little bit a year later. So, you know, they arise, because not just here, an obvious location for the memorials, but in Manchester, of course, and slightly earlier, Albert Memorial there, starting in 1865. So it was sort of a national shock and a national determination to commemorate the great man.
And the Albert Memorial that's just across the road from this building.
Yes, isn't it fascinating? I said the whole of this area tends to be classical, and the great amphitheatre of the Albert Hall is a great expression of that. But of course, the memorial is Gothic, and that was chosen specifically by the Queen, you see. And why Gothic? Well, it was the taste of the time, but also the associations. It was a sort of edifice that would go above an altar, above the tomb of a saint. Very appropriate, of course, in Victoria's vision. So that appears. And you know, money was raised by public appeal. It wasn't so therefore had to have an element of support. And I mean, it was popular, but it took a long time to build, over 10 years. And I suppose the perception of her mourning being prolonged, the memory of Albert is somewhat eclipsed by 1875, I think, when the statue of Albert eventually is installed. So it does mark a change in perception of the whole thing. But yes, popular, yeah.
There's two paradoxical side of this, though, isn't there, Kate? Because whilst the Albert Memorial is being raised and burnished over the road here, there is some element of public perception that says this queen has mourned too long and too deeply.
Yes, I mean, this is a very big swell of opinion, particularly among Republican opinion, that Victoria had mourned too long. And really, she was a victim of her own success, because Victoria instituted the notion that the monarch should tour the regions, should be perpetually visible, very unlike the previous kings. It was really only Elizabeth I, as her predecessor, who toured. And so as a consequence, when she stopped going out, when she stopped showing herself driving in open carriages, the country couldn't cope with it. They saw her as failing her role as queen. So they were rather shocked, but it was a difficult tightrope for her, because on one hand, they wanted their queen to be visible. On the other hand, it was a woman's job to mourn their husband with great, intense emotion. Women were expected to mourn and hardly go out. So it was hard to fulfil the role of both monarch and fit woman. So she would have been criticised whatever she did, I feel.
OK. The Albert Memorial, in later years, became a kind of locus of anti-Victorianism, didn't it? It was the edifice that modernists loved to hate. How quickly did that happen, Dan?
Certainly in the 1950s, all of great Victorian monuments, including, you know, St. Pancras Station, the Great Midland Hotel, were regarded as monstrosities or curiosities at best. The battle to save them, of course, had started, I suppose, in the 1950s, people like John Betjeman. The memorial really wasn't condemned, it simply was allowed to rot. And what's interesting about, you know, the statue of Albert, gilded originally, want to be gilded now, some point in the early 20th century was painted black. I mean, interesting, and the whole thing is almost painted out, made invisible, reduced in its impact. And of course, I think it almost falls down, really, and there's a great campaign to save it. But it's a victim of forgetfulness or carelessness rather than, you know, direct attack upon it.
We started this by looking for traces of Albert in the streets of Kensington. Maybe we should end by trying to detect his influence on our culture now. Are there still Albertine cultural projects, Kate?
Well, Albert particularly, he thought that Britain, when he arrived, he thought we had terrible food, awful weather, surprise, awful weather, bad, we were often drinking and we hadn't really got many cultural interests. So he was determined to reform him, and he was determined on moral reform as well, particularly of Britain's court. So I don't know whether we can see his moral reformation as really succeeding, but certainly his attempt to his idea that the royal family should patronise the arts, not just portraits of themselves, but should patronise the arts for the public, has become absolutely crucial, I think. And I think we're very interested now to see what Kate and William will do in terms of their cultural patronage, because the royal family have an incredible amount of power now to patronise the arts, which hopefully they will do.
But is the museum culture that we have, for instance, can we attribute that to him?
Yes, I do think that this obsession, that the marriage of art, science, for commerce, for manufacture, the unity of effort, which was so much behind driving, you know, the ideas behind the whole area we're sitting in now, was very important. Of course, we do have an arts and crafts movement in the late 19th century. The craft as a project, Albert doesn't invent that, but he certainly promotes it. People like William Morris carried on and see a way arts and science can be applied to the manufacturing and indeed to somehow mitigate the excesses of you know, the machine age and the heartlessness that came in the late 19th century. That route can be traced back. Obviously, it's interesting now where we have the Prince of Wales also pursuing architectural projects, whether or not Prince Albert, who was a great enthusiast of the modern in many ways and of technology and science, would have quite have gone along with Poundry, but I think he would have completely supported us with the enthusiasm of the Prince of Wales for creating through architecture a better world, I suppose, a world that he's perceived to be better by some people.
Is Charles the heir of Albert in any real sense, Kate?
I think there are ways in which Charles is, just as Dan was saying, the idea that architecture is important, how our buildings look is crucially important, Albert terribly believed in. But also Albert was obsessed with the sanctity of the family and obsessed with promoting himself as a perfect family man. And that was the role he carved out for himself. And obviously Charles's life has been slightly different, so there is that contrast there. But I think that most of all, I mean, that what was most important about Albert was his death. I mean, that you know he's like Marilyn Monroe. He became much more famous through death than he ever would have been. Nelson, if he lived and become a rather cross old man just speaking German to his grandchildren at the end of his life. So we do romanticise him because he died so young.
And what's your relationship with this icon? How do you think of this man, Dan?
I think he's a great man. I often think about him, funnily enough. Coming around here, certainly Albert Memorial, certainly the whole idea of a commitment to architecture is something which has become rather important in my life. And, you know, and he had a very strong architectural beliefs, which he was able to, one way or another, express. And through that expression, gave London a great architectural monument and a wonderful bit of city.
And that's where this programme comes to its appointed end. And we conclude our contemplation of Albert's, which means that it's your moment to thank my guests tonight, Dan Cruickshank and Kate Williams. And thank you too.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event. The producer was Georgia Mann. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom with me, Tom Service. Prepare yourselves for one of the greatest emotional journeys in the whole symphonic literature. We're going to hear Mahler's Sixth Symphony, a piece whose darkness Bruno Walter, the conductor, thought too depressing ever to perform. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, a lot of them too, are regrouping on stage beneath me, and Semyon Bishkov will be taking up this huge conducting challenge. Now, you can't have tragedy without hope, just as you can't experience real darkness without first knowing light. And the four movements of the Sixth Symphony, which Mahler composed between 1903 and 1904, contain all of the expressive extremes that Mahler could create from this gigantic orchestra. Tonight there are 126 musicians in the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Looking down just at the percussion section, give you an idea, I can see two sets of timpani, there are two celestas, there are cowbells, cymbals, gongs, and there's a gigantic wooden sledgehammer and a large wooden box, a primitive pair of instruments that will seal the tragic trajectory of the symphony and the climaxes of the finale with two huge hammer blows. There are also four harps. So this musical journey starts with the march-like tread of the opening movement and ends with the fantastical nightmarescape of the finale, the biggest single symphonic movement ever written up to this point. It's music that constantly fascinates tonight's conductor, Semyon Bishkov.
There is one interval that goes on through the symphony. It is an octave. It's the same note that's played either low and then one octave higher, or it's played first higher and then going one octave down. It's the same interval that goes throughout. And I kept thinking about the meaning of this octave. And when it goes up, it really makes you think of a human aspiration. When it goes down, particularly in the last movement, it makes me feel as if it were a credo. And as we know, aspiration is very difficult to fulfill, whereas the credo is extremely hard to defend. And it's the confrontation between aspiration and the belief, the credo, which for me is the core of this music, which is the core of his life. It is the core of everyone's life. And this is why, even though this is a very personal music, it's very autobiographical symphony, strangely enough composed at the time when he and his wife Alma, they were so happy with one child that they had, that the second one was on the way. The piece is very tragic in meaning, not all of it, but quite a lot of it, as if a foreboding of the future that brought all these blows of fate to him that are signified, in fact, by the two hammer strikes in the last movement. And I think this is what makes it such a powerful piece, what he really does with it and how he confronts the aspiration and the credo.
Tonight's conductor, Semyon Bishkov. Well, the programmatic symbolism of those hammer blows in the finale was maybe overinterpreted by Mahler's wife, Alma. She said that in 1907 there were three hammer blows of fate that befell Mahler. One was that he was forced to resign as conductor of the Vienna Staatsoper. There was the death of his daughter Maria, and he was diagnosed with a potentially, or what would prove to be, fatal lesion of the heart. See, the problem with this theory is that that all happened three years, after the symphony was completed. And surely the true prophecy of the music is what happens in its musical trajectory. In other words, that we as listeners, if we engage fully with this music, we all become the heroes of this symphony. You know, this gigantic experience of hope and despair, aspiration and belief that Semyon Bishkov was talking about happens to all of us over the next 80 minutes. For all its giganticism and this huge mass of the BBC Symphony Orchestra on stage, there are moments of huge, of real intimacy in this symphony as well. In the first movement, one of my favourite passages is, sounds like a warped music box, woodwinds and celeste, a very simple tune floats over the orchestra. So here comes tonight's conductor, Semyon Bishkov, to conduct Mahler's Sixth Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
the end of Mahler's Sixth Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. The BBC Symphony Orchestra is conducted by Semyon Bishkov. He's yet to acknowledge the applause, still in the rapt tragedy of the end of that symphony. He shakes the leader of the orchestra, Andrew Haviland's hand. That long silence at the end of so tragic a finale symbolises the power of that music. We as an audience, and maybe you at home too, you don't know whether to, or what to do at the end of that piece. You've been through the journey that Mahler has taken the hero on. You are effectively exhausted, extinguished at the end of that piece. 20 seconds of indecision, a sort of spiritual shadow that was broken by the first beginnings of the round of applause. But of course, how you hear that whole symphony depends on what your view of tragedy is, whether you think, like the conductor Bruno Walter, that this piece was simply too dark, is simply too bleak to confront properly, or like Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher, that through tragedy, it's only by confronting tragedy that we can finally say yes to life. Well, the Royal Albert Hall, and maybe you at home too, returning to life after that performance. The 126 musicians of the BBC Symphony Orchestra applaud Semyon Bishkov as he comes on stage to accept the applause from this sold-out Royal Albert Hall. The orchestra now standing to their feet. Four harps, two celestas, seven percussionists. I don't know how the two hammer blows sounded on your speakers, but they rocked. Certainly this part of the Albert Hall, the percussionist with the gigantic wooden sledgehammer was only a few feet away from our box, and the hundreds of us gathered behind the first violins here. More energy, perhaps, than other performances in that finale. Maybe more desperation, too, a sense of clinging on to the life, the energy, the momentum of the music. Semyon Bishkov coming again on stage to the stamped feet and applause of approval of the full house here. Proms to enjoy tomorrow. Oh, there's applause there for the BBC Symphony Orchestra's principal trumpeter, Michael Moller. Bit of a heroic achievement, that performance. The rest of the trumpet section, and really the whole, so many solos that Mahler's orchestration demands you pay attention to. Sam Elliott on tuba, the principal horn, Martin Owen. Proms to enjoy tomorrow, Saturday matinee at the Cadogan Hall, 3 o'clock, music by Hildegard of Bingen, Benjamin Britten, Harrison Birtwistle, and a world premiere from Stevie Wishart. And then at 7:30, the Tonhalle Orchestra of Zurich, conducted by David Simmern, Mozart, the piano concerto, his last, number 27, with Maria Joao Pires, and then Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, and a UK premiere of Anders Hillborough. And Semyon Bishkov is still going around the orchestra, bringing musicians to their feet. The whole percussion section there, led, as ever, by principal trumpetist John Chimes. Principal flute Michael Cox as well. But really, the rapture of this audience is what's lingering, is what's staying with us after that performance of Mahler's Sixth Symphony. And so, with this huge acclaim ringing around the hall, time to hand you back for the rest of this evening's programmes on Radio 3, the Broadcasting House.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. That was Tom Service there at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. By the sounds of it, they're not going to leave for quite some time. Well, if you tuned in halfway through that magical performance of Mahler's Sixth Symphony and would like to hear the whole of it again, then there is a chance to do so on Monday afternoon here on Radio 3. It's going to be the subject of our afternoon BBC prom. You can hear it in full from 2:30 on Monday. Or, of course, at any time you'd like to hear it for the next 7 days, you can go to the Radio 3 website and click on Listen Again. Also on Monday, by the way, at lunchtime, the next in our Proms Chamber Music series, which comes live from Cadogan Hall in West London, the cellist Yo-Yo Ma teams up with Catherine Stott to play pieces by Graham Fitkin, Egberto Gismonti and Geraldo Canero. And then to end their recital, the cello sonata in G minor by Rachmaninoff. We'll be there with our chamber prom on Radio 3 at 1:00 on Monday afternoon. Well, we're off back in history in a few minutes, back to the days when the Romans were in Britain. It's the second of two features this week, taking a look at what it was really like when Britain was part of the mighty and vast Roman Empire. Earlier this week, we considered whether the Romans were welcome when they first came to these islands. Well, tonight, Bethany Hughes explores the catastrophic effect of the end of the empire on Britain. Why did London suddenly become a ghost town when the empire collapsed? And who arrived to try to make the most of the political and economic vacuum? You can find out in a fascinating study, The Birth of the Britons, tonight at 10 o'clock. Then we conclude a week-long look at the Strange Movement, which gave birth to the Reithian principles still at the heart of the BBC, the Music Appreciation Movement. Tonight it branches into film and faces its demise in our essay at 11:15, and that's followed by a conversation about the band Fool's Gold, the subject of World Roots this evening. Two of their founder members talk to Lopa Kattari at 11. But to take us to the Romans, a duet, Paul Lewis and Stephen Osborne, play Schubert. Stephen Osborne and Paul Lewis in that fugue by Schubert, Deutsch 952. Well, now on Radio 3, The Romans in Britain, and the second of two programmes this week in which Bethany Hughes explores the end of empire.
Leggett, I had the news last night. My cohort ordered home by ship to Portus Itius and thence by road to Rome. I've marched the companies aboard. The arms are stowed below. Now let another take my sword. Command me not to go.
The first dead civilization that comes into our minds is, I suppose, the civilization of the Greeks and Romans. Its breakdown and collapse come home to us rather closely, because our own civilization arose out of its ruins. The decline and fall of the Roman Empire, is something like that going to happen now to us? And what was it that did happen when the Roman Empire fell? Why do we think of its fall as having been such a catastrophe?
Rudyard Kipling's Centurion, as he prepares to leave Britannia, and the anxious post-World War II analysis of Arnold Toynbee. Two very different meditations on the vanished empire that we love to scrutinise and to celebrate. Such has been our identification with the Romans as an imperial power that their fate, for some, becomes a portent of our own future. But in fact, just as new archaeology shows us the arrival of the Romans was rather a complex, variegated and piecemeal affair, so was Rome's departure.
We have, if you like, all grown up with the schoolboy or schoolgirl view of Roman Britain, the Rudyard Kipling view of the soldier on Hadrian's Wall. You know, there's a familiarity to that. The problem is that Roman Britain is probably a very alien place, and it's a place that's actually very difficult to interpret because we lack the sources, but also because the people who lived here weren't conforming to those Roman stereotypes that we'd like them to conform to. And I mean, by the late empire, sort of after 250, 300, into the 4th century, things have changed.
In Leadenhall Market in London, in the heart of the city, archaeologist James Gerard of the Macdonald Institute, Cambridge, joined me for a view of Londinium's political, fiscal and social centre, the Basilica. As I found, its remains are located somewhere a little surprising.
There's a wonderful sign in here which says 10 hairdressing positions and shoe shine, plus ancient monument downstairs. And somebody is having one of the 10 hairdressing positions above, but we need to descend down the steps. Not the most obvious place for an archaeological tour.
Well hidden.
So we've come down two flights of stairs. Oh, there's a whole other huge hairdresser's down here. A nice sharp smell of Brill cream. Danker and more humid in here, isn't it? So we've just left the city gents behind, and suddenly what we're looking at, you've got the typical kind of flat, very slim Roman bricks. It is, I mean, I can smell the humidity, and actually it's covered in a kind of slightly black mould, but it still looks quite sturdy, this section.
And this is part of the Great Basilica of Roman London. And this is one of the largest public building in the city.
Isn't it the biggest Roman building north of the Alps?
Certainly the largest Roman building in Britain. Absolutely huge civic centre.
Could have been on a similar size to St Paul's Cathedral, where they've been able to identify where some of the piers were. So how big that was relative to other buildings in Europe, but it would certainly have been very significant here.
And its story is really the story of the city, from its birth as a boom town in the late 1st century through to its demise as a Roman city in the early 5th.
When we see a great building like this reduced to fragments, we might imagine triumphant barbarians gawping at ruins that they could never replicate. But that picture couldn't be further from the truth. Londoners themselves dismantled their own enormous basilica because, by the year 300, it no longer suited the needs of their changing city. They were still enmeshed in their complex dialogue with Romanitas right the way through the 4th century, little knowing that they were about to pass a point of no return. Guy Halsall of York University.
If you were born, for example, in say, about 365 in Britain, you'd have been born into a world where You could go to a town, you could go to a theatre in a town and see, presumably see a Roman play. You could go to the markets in town and you could buy things produced by specialist craftsmen. You could acquire pottery produced in Gaul and presumably objects from all across the rest of certainly the Western Roman Empire and possibly further afield. So you have a complicated economy that's based on coinage, that's based on towns, you pay taxes, and then if you were of the right social class, you might go back to your villa where you'd be living in this elaborately decorated house, but certainly a fairly complex piece of architecture.
It's natural, I suppose, to take for granted the world one has been born and brought up in. Certainly English people of my own age, who were just grown up before 1914, did take for granted our modern Western civilization. All the same, this notion that our civilization might come to grief seems now to be in the air.
You died aged, say, about 60, in, say, about 425. You died and you left behind a world where none of those things existed anymore, where towns had more or less been abandoned completely, where coinage was no longer being produced, as coinage anyway. So presumably economic transactions had been reduced to barter and gift exchange and things like that. You would no longer be living in a villa because villas are dangerous places to live if you can't keep them up properly. And the material culture, the pottery, things like that had all collapsed. So it really is, I would say, the most dramatic, most catastrophic period of economic and social collapse that Britain has ever witnessed. It's really very difficult to imagine what it would be like to have been that hypothetical person born 365, dying 425. The world they came into was just a completely different world.
These changes seem to generate a sense of unease, fragility, fear. In the echoing storerooms of the Museum of London, James showed me a set of intriguing finds. The Draper's Garden Hoard, only recently unearthed, that opens a unique window onto this uncertain moment in time.
Well, we have one of the largest hoards of Roman copper alloy vessels excavated in recent times. This hoard is 20 or so pewter, iron and bronze vessels, and I'm taking out at the moment a large bucket, which looks very much like something you might find next to your granny's fireplace with logs in it, and it was found in the base of a Roman well. And we know that the hoard was deposited sometime after about AD 375, because we have two coins from below the hoard that give the dating. They may have been placed in the well first. Then we had a copper alloy bracelet, which had been deliberately broken, that had been placed in. Then the vessels stacked up, and then there had been dirt shoveled in on top. And then we had probably the joints of a very young deer placed on top. The whole series of actors, if you like, people, had come together to perform different activities in depositing this hoard. And once you stack all those things up, then this does really start to look like some kind of ritual activity.
I'm going to put you on the spot. We've got, what, 10, 11, 12 plastic boxes around us, just full of things. Put all together, what do you think this curious deposit symbolises? What does it tell us about this period of Roman Britain?
I think it's telling us that we have a society that is undergoing some social stress. So if you're taking a well out of commission, what you're actually saying is, we're not living here anymore. So it may well be that this is a ritual act closing down activity in this part of the city, that the Roman economic system, in London at least, is faltering, that people are moving elsewhere, leading different types of lives, and in an effort to appease the supernatural world before they move on, they bury these things in their source of fresh water, backfill the well, and thus symbolically close their occupation of that part of the Roman city.
It's coming to be the end of their world as they know it.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
The late Roman Empire is already fragmented. For a start, it's split into two territories, east and west, each with their own emperor. And you wouldn't find the court of the Western Emperor where you'd expect it to be, in Rome. Instead, the emperors of the West liked to be up north at Trier, keeping a close eye on the barbarians, plus their own potentially dangerous generals. When the imperial court did move south again to Italy in 381, the shift in focus spelt trouble.
Ability of local aristocrats in northern Gaul and Britain to get access to the emperor, to be able to get close to the imperial court, was made that much more difficult. Their sense of involvement in the empire was reduced, and I think it's not surprising, therefore, that within a year or two of the emperor Gratian moving the court and everything back to Italy, produced a stress and strain and produced this usurpation of Magnus Maximus, the commander of the British army. And in popular memory in Western Europe, in Britain and in Gaul, Maximus is remembered very often as the last decent emperor.
Maximus in the 380s, and then the later failed usurper Constantine III, who followed the same path in the year 407, are key to our story. Both were raised by the British garrison, but were not themselves Britons. Both would strip Britannia of her field armies and sail across the Channel to do battle with their rivals for control of the Western Empire. And both met death and defeat on the fields of conflict that they created. Invaders quietly took advantage of the disorder and started to seep across the borders. Even so, the main threat was now not the enemy without, but the enemy within.
The political problem for the Romans with Britain is not separatism, it's usurpation. And what usurpation means is people setting themselves up as emperor. And they don't set themselves up as emperor of Britain, they set themselves up as Roman emperor, as emperor of the Roman Empire. Many perfectly legitimate emperors start off as usurpers. Constantine I started off as a usurper. It's when if you win, you become an emperor just like everybody else. If you lose, then you remain a usurper and a baddie, and you're written down in history as basically a loser.
Frustratingly, between the usurpations, just at the point where the power politics get really interesting, our written sources dry up. So we have to turn elsewhere for help. Numismatist Philippa Walton is working on the huge dataset of records for Roman coins collected by the Portable Antiquities Scheme. She joined James and me at Leadenhall Market.
And this is where coins really come into their own. Roman numismatics is an area that a lot of archaeologists are very sniffy about. They don't really like using coin evidence. At the end of the 4th century and into the early 5th century, that's the only sort of type of material culture that we have a lot of in Roman Britain that we can actually date. So we've got coins arriving in Britain until around 402 and probably being used into the 5th century, maybe for as long as 20 years.
But at this stage in Roman history, how are coins being used in a market like this?
We generally have the idea that coins are used for buying and selling objects on a very low-level, everyday sort of transaction type thing. But in the late Roman period, it's not certain that they're being used in that way. In fact, you don't seem to find that many Roman coins in towns. And there's an idea that they were being used for more administrative purposes, to pay the army and the civil service, and also to as a way of collecting taxation. But normal, everyday life wouldn't have involved coinage all the time.
From the coins, what picture do you get of this period?
The general overview that we have is that there's a decline throughout the 4th century. That probably coin use continues until around the 370s, 380s, but after that we don't really have that much evidence for coins being used in great numbers in London.
Coins are a crucial indicator of imperial health. Subjects use them to pay taxes, overlords to wage the army. The last newly minted coins that come into Britain arrive just a few years before Constantine III and his failed bid to control the Western Empire.
After Constantine, no official government ever returns to Britain that we know about. And of course, Constantine's defeat means more Roman troops from the northwest being killed by other Romans, more units not being replaced or sent back. Not only is there no official system, no sanctioned, legitimised official system collecting these taxes, but exactly where they would be sending them to anyway is by no means clear after this date. The Rhine frontier has really been left in complete tatters, partly by barbarian invasion, but mainly by the withdrawal of troops to fight these civil wars. So this ongoing cycle, which had been going on for hundreds of years really by now, is broken. The aristocracy has lost one of its most important late Roman reasons to exist, which is to collect taxes.
No tax, no pay for your armies, no tax system. And the whole purpose and power base of your tax-collecting elite vanishes. That's what causes radical change. The very reason for invading Britain in the first place, to make money, is now entirely redundant. Britannia's usurpers led to economic ruin and to the entire province gradually alienating herself from the increasingly fragile empire. There's almost an unwillingness for us to believe this, that the tipping point for Romano-Britishness was not some apocalyptic battle with thuggish barbarians, but a seemingly innocent administrative move, just apparent with hindsight.
For me, what the 5th century is about, the disappearance of, if you like, institutionalised power and the development of personal power. So in the late Roman period, you could be a Roman aristocrat living in your villa, reading Virgil or whatever, drinking wine, and your position is assured by the Roman state. In the 5th century, the Roman state isn't there. So you have to then become a war leader. And this is how we move, if you like, from villa owners to war bands.
Without the backing of the Roman state, the backing of the Roman army, to be brutal about it, how did they stay aristocrats? They also, one imagines, needed to divert resources to having their own bodyguard, what would become a war band or a retinue, all of which is taking away whatever surplus that they could extract from their little locality. So it's not very surprising that they don't have the money, the surplus left over, to pay specialist tile producers, to pay specialist stone cutters and all the other people they would need, that they don't take themselves out of those little political arenas and go off and live in towns for half the year. It's no surprise that towns, for very similar reasons, fizzle out. Two people living in a shed in the ruins of Canterbury don't make a town. And the overall context is one of complete collapse.
Traditionally, the end is said to be 1600 years ago. The year 410, when the Emperor Honorius was thought to have written to the Britons, telling them to look to their own defence. But some scholars argue the Emperor never put pen to parchment. The garbled historical source we rely on has a misspelling, which some say could be Brutium in Italy, not Britannia after all. Nobody knows for sure. So would 411, the annus of failure and the death of the usurper Constantine III, perhaps be a better bet? We historians do like our dates, so can we pinpoint one?
I don't think there is a final moment as such. I think it's like a very gradual sort of turning off of the lights over 20, 30 years, rather than 410 arrives, they get on their ships, they go home, they wave goodbye to their girlfriends, and the army's gone, there's no Roman Britain. I don't think it happened like that. People just don't switch off their identity overnight.
And the pattern's very complex, as Philippa says. You know, we're talking about changes from region to region within the British Isles, and possibly even from valley system to valley system. And it's very difficult to study those. Some areas may have clung on to their Romanitas longer than others. Some may have bought into the Anglo-Saxon way of life much earlier than others. And it's charting that is very difficult. If something happens quickly and everywhere, that's easy, we can do that. But as soon as it becomes complex, fragmented, it becomes much more difficult to study as an archaeologist.
Things become more difficult for the historian too. We come down to essentially one main written source for the 5th century, a monk called Gildas, who probably lived in the west of the island and wrote in the early 6th century. Gildas composed a short historical preface to his passionate discourse on the ruin of Britain.
Then a pack of cubs burst forth from the lair of the barbarian lioness, coming in three keels, as they call warships in their language. The winds were favourable to the omens and auguries which prophesied, according to a sure portent among them, that they would live for 300 years in the land to which their prows were directed.
His is an account of pagan Saxons invading Britain from their Germanic homeland and joining forces with Saxons who were already here serving in the Roman armies. But it's a sermon, a real woe unto you rant. It's not reliable history at all. To Gildas, the Saxons represent a divine scourge for our sins. There's little room for nuance here, but archaeology shows a more complex picture. Not all those in Britain moving towards a Saxon warrior lifestyle were Saxons. Far from hanging about to civilise the natives, a Kipling-type centurion might have been living a very different post-colonial existence. Archaeologist David Petts from Durham University and historian Alex Wolfe of St Andrews at the key Roman fort of Binchester, near Darlington.
We have some fairly easy things to see. We do have a large stone barrack. You can see the walls parallel to us. Big stone walls, about a foot and a half thick. But across the top of that, there are lots of spreads of rubble, flagstones, features cut into the floors. Some of these are no doubt very late Roman, but we're increasingly thinking that we've also got a significant amount of 5th century post-Roman activity going on here. Previous excavations at this fort revealed evidence for 5th century activity in the commander's house, and we've got a couple of features where we've got evidence for working antler and working jet, which appears very similar to the 5th century material found elsewhere in the fort. So it's almost accepted now that if we dig a Roman fort in the north carefully, we will find evidence for early post-Roman activity. But it's the potential scale of it here in Binchester. We've always known there was stuff in the centre near the commander's house, but here we're right away, right in the northeast corner of the fort, yet we're still picking up evidence for this 5th century activity going on here.
Who do you imagine it is sitting in there, David, in this 5th century fort?
I still find it very hard to actually really make my own decision about what's happening here. I think on the whole it's most likely that in the early stages we do have the local fort commander seizing power initially or continuing to exercise power. He can't pay his troops, but he can lead them on raids, they can extort, they can exert tributes from the surrounding areas. The whole enclosure stopped being a fort though. What is clear, we've got continuity, but you know, this building stops being a barrack and certainly seems to become a centre for craft activity. If a Roman general had ridden through here in AD 450, he'd have been very upset about the lack of whitewashed roadstones and nicely kept up barracks. I think it would have looked very, very different. And much more like, to be honest, an Anglo-Saxon village.
Alex, can you look at that lump of stone and imagine what's going on here in the 5th century?
Yes, I can. And it is particularly exciting because when Roman forts started to be excavated in the first half of the 20th century, people just hacked down till they got to the stone foundations. And so that even if there had been Dark Age material, it would have ended up on the spoil heap. These are the days before metal detectors and before decent wet sieving. So we are seeing stuff that has been destroyed by archaeologists on lots of other sites. Big questions are questions of what is the nature of the continuity. Should we imagine that these are Roman soldiers, Roman officials, who only gradually come to realise that there's going to be no more pay packets and no more changes of orders coming from the centre? Are they other people, locals or invaders, who have moved in after the troops have moved out? And how did they think about themselves? Did they think that it was good to be self-consciously un-Roman, or were they trying to prop up Romanitas?
Binchester's archaeological sequence ends with Saxon burials in what was once the commander's house. The Saxon peoples might, for a time, have gladly sported the prestigious garb of a Roman soldier, but now things have changed. From the 430s, they went to the grave in Britain with their own distinctive weapons. The Romano-British increasingly had to make a judgment, to decide whether the future had a Saxon or a Roman tinge, and to dress and worship accordingly. Not every Saxon-style grave in Britain contains a Saxon corpse. But while in the East, Roman-ness seemed to be going out of fashion, amid the chaotic patchwork of people trying on different identities or ditching them, it was in the West that the situation became really interesting. So I got myself onto the M4 and headed to Wales.
We've made our way up above Carnarvon town. You can probably hear from the sound of the wind, we're at a pretty good vantage point up here.
It's, I think, the highest point in this town. You're going to get a really good view of Anglesey across the Menai, and back on a clear day, which it isn't today, you can see Snowdon and all the mountains in the background. Very spectacular.
I met archaeologist Roger White at the Roman fort of Saguntium in the former Roman province of Britannia Prima, an area covering modern-day Wales, Devon and Cornwall. Saguntium stands proud above the town, 170 miles or so from the ancient provincial capital, probably Cirencester. Though a pretty quiet place in the 21st century, in the late Roman Empire, this area enjoyed a marked degree of potency and independence.
The crucial difference between what happens in the West and the East is what happens after the collapse and effect of central government. What seems to have happened here in the West is that this provincial government, which had been set up at the beginning of the 4th century, they appear to have decided to keep things going. They've managed to keep the civil service going, and then crucially, they managed to keep the army going somehow. They managed to persuade the army to basically keep on defending this area. And presumably they did that by paying them, by saying, we'll take the responsibility and we will pay you. And they recruit troops and they defend themselves.
So does that mean, or do you think that for them, 410 is a less significant year? That there isn't a sense that the Romans leave in 410 AD?
If we take Roxeter, which is our best excavated sequence we've got in this part of the world, you've got a town there, fourth largest town in Roman Britain, which you cannot see 410 at all. Basically, the archaeology continues in an unbroken way right through the 5th century, right to the very end of the 5th century. They're still using the public baths, they're still using the basilica next to it. It's still a functioning public building. It's becoming increasingly decrepit, and it's very clear from the pottery, for example, that they are still using Roman pottery, but they're repairing it. They're finding it very difficult to replace it. They're still using coins, it appears, until very late in the 5th century. We have all the appearance of a functioning Roman society, and that is the crucial difference between here and the east of England, where this does not seem to have happened.
Part of the reason the province did so well may have been because it was already handling its own military affairs from the late 4th century onwards, thanks to the usurpation of the Spaniard Magnus Maximus. We're dealing with maybes and possibles here, but there is a curious finds distribution of late Roman army metalwork that could back up this picture. Whatever the reason, this obscure usurper is a major figure in Welsh legend. In medieval Welsh, Magnus is Maxen Vledig, Vledig meaning lord. The late Sir Mortimer Wheeler, who dug this fort, introduces the myth.
And the story tells us how Maximus, or Maxen, came to Carnarvon and was born in his dream ship there to the Roman fort, where he saw, I'm quoting the words from Mabinogion, a fair hall of which the roof seemed to be all gold. Golden seats in the hall, and golden tables, and two auburn-haired youths playing at chess. A silver board for the chess, and golden pieces thereon. And beside a pillar in the hall, he saw a hoary-headed man in a chair of ivory, with the figures of two eagles of rich gold thereon, a man of powerful aspect. A chessboard of gold was before him, and a rod of gold, and a steel file in his hand, and he was carving out chessmen.
Magnus Maximus basically seized power in 383. And traditionally, he is the person who is meant to have taken all the troops from here, from Britannia Prima, and taken them across the continent. And basically, in Welsh legend, he is the man who hands over power to the Welsh. So if you've got the, for example, in mid Wales, there is the Pillar of Eliseg, a stone monument which has a long inscription which is now lost, but was copied in the 17th century. And that traces the lineage of one of the Welsh royal families. And right at the beginning, it starts with Maxen Vledig.
Quite a satisfying way that even though he ultimately failed, that is how he's lived on in legend here.
This is the basis of the Welsh kings and princes. This is the basis of their power. You know, that their authority to rule had been handed to them by Rome and by the Roman emperor.
Sometimes they use Roman titles, so that Stone in South Wales, where a character called Vortipor or Vorticor calls himself Protector. And Protector is a Roman title. There are other references to people being described as Kiwis, a citizen. Even a 6th century tombstone from Penmacno in the middle of Snowdonia, which is dated according to a consular date, And remember that as well, that the sources that we have for the 5th century are Gildas and a St. Patrick. Even our kind of Latin literary creations come from this part of the world. And it's been suggested that perhaps this was a golden age of Romanness in what's now Wales and maybe Cumbria and the southwestern peninsula as well.
Romanness in Wales, famous for initially holding out against the Romans. But this was the birth of a strange new kind of Romanitas, a culture that might well have puzzled some of the pockets of Romano-British who clung on elsewhere in Britannia and would almost certainly have appeared entirely alien to a visitor from Ravenna or Rome.